second case for oral argument this morning is Anita Leslie, appellant versus Heidi Foods Appley. For the appellant is Ms. Kevin Sabres, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee, Mr. Gary Timpson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Richard Sabres has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the honorable appointee civil judge from the First Judicial Circuit to sit in Justice Sabres' place. Ms. Sabres, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, members of the audience, as Justice Gilbertson stated, my name is Catherine Sabres, and I am here today representing the appellant and the plaintiff below, Ms. Anita Leslie. Ms. Leslie is here asking this court today to reverse an order of summary judgment granted by the Honorable Kathleen Caldwell, which in effect dismissed her claims for retaliation under Title VII and the Civil Rights Act, and also her claims of hostile work environment, sexual harassment under that same act. It is our opinion that there are genuine issues of fact on both these issues, and thus reversal of that grant of summary judgment is warranted. Because our time is somewhat limited here today, I would like to primarily focus on the retaliation claim that we have made, as I believe there are four particular areas of error with regard to that retaliation claim.
Even though your time is limited, could you take about a minute and inform the audience of what this case is about factually?
I'd be happy to, and actually I'd ask the court's indulgence to go through the chronology of what happened here, because the chronology really does play into the retaliation claim. Ms. Leslie was an employee of the Hy-Vee, 3030 Minnesota Hy-Vee in Sioux Falls, South Dakota for 13 and a half years prior to January of 2000. For the last 6 years of her employment, she was acting in a capacity as personnel manager for that particular store. In approximately April of 2000, the store had a new store manager come on. The store manager's name was Paul Cole. In April, he became the store manager and worked closely with Ms. Leslie. They shared an office. There was a partial divider between the office, but Ms. Leslie had to walk through his office to be in her office, and they worked together quite closely. In July of 2000, shortly after he came to the store, he gave Ms. Leslie a performance evaluation. And that performance evaluation is filed with our exhibits to our brief. And I'm sure the court has looked at that and can see that Ms. Leslie was given an outstanding rating by Mr. Cole, particularly in the area of her loyalty to the store manager and store personnel. She was given a rating of very good, which is the second to highest rating in her interpersonal relationships with the store. That was July of 2000. In October of 2000, and the best that we can put together from the record is October 16th and 17th of 2000, Ms. Leslie placed two phone calls. She placed a phone call to the Human Resources Department at Hy-Vee, and in that conversation, she made a number of complaints about Mr. Cole. Particularly, she complained of his use of the F-U-C-K word on an often basis, of inappropriate jokes, that she was made uncomfortable, as well as complaints of other management-related problems. What is absent from the circuit court's decision, and very important in our opinion to her retaliation claim, is the call she made the next day. The next day she called corporate vice president Ray Stewart and wanted to voice additional complaints with regard to Mr. Cole. Mr. Stewart referred her to Monty Weiss, who is the director of operations for this division of Hy-Vee. Mr. Weiss confirms that he spoke with her. He confirms that she did bring up these issues of vulgar language, of references to specific female by using the phrase tit reductions, and part of my language, but that is the language that was referred to. Also that he ordered the termination of another female into an employee in her presence by using the phrase fire the B-I-T-C-H. Mr. Weiss, he also confirmed that Ms. Leslie had told him of an occasion where very pregnant female employee had come into the office and asked for a shift change. The employee was treated very rudely in Ms. Leslie's presence. The employee left the room in tears. Then Mr. Cole proceeded to tell Ms. Leslie, who was also 6 to 7 months pregnant at the time, "My little girl is going to waltz in here and tell me how to run my operation." And that's not a direct quote, but basically the gist of what she explained to him. Also that he gave her the impression by some questions he followed up with that he was angry about giving pregnant employees benefits, obviously distressing to Ms. Leslie as she was also pregnant at the time. After this conversation, Mr. Weiss assured Ms. Leslie he would investigate the situation. He confirms that he spoke with Mr. Cole, and importantly, he explains that he went to the store to investigate, and he uses the word investigate. He says it's a little more hard to investigate, quote, charges against a store manager when those charges are against a store manager. And importantly, another fact not referenced in the opinion of the circuit court, he told, in his deposition, he informed us that he did not give Ms. Leslie's name at this particular conference because it was important that he protect her, and he felt that this would protect her. This was in the week or two after October 17th. After this conversation, Mr. Weissy explains that he called Vice Stewart, who was the corporate vice president, said he investigated and thought that they should all three sit down, being Ray Stewart, Paul Cole, and himself, and discuss the situation. Ray Stewart indicated to him that that was not necessary and that Mr. Stewart would speak with Paul Cole on his own. Putting the testimony of Paul Cole and Monty Weiss together, there's a definite inference from the record that this conversation occurred on November 2nd of 2000. At that time, Mr. Stewart and Mr. Cole spoke about the complaints, and according to Mr. Cole's testimony, the store manager's testimony, he decided as soon as the complaints were discussed that he would, quote, terminate Ms. Leslie. Now, admittedly, he does backtrack later and say, "I decided she would no longer work in the store." That's November 2nd of 2000. That same day, Monty Weiss explains he received a phone call from Ray Stewart saying Anita Leslie is not going to work in the 33rd in Minnesota store anymore, and she's not going to work in a position of personnel manager. And that's stated in Monty Weiss's testimony. The next day, Monty Weiss informed Ms. Leslie she'd no longer be at the 33rd in Minnesota store, that there was possibility that of other positions. He had not investigated those positions at the time of that conference. 3 days later, Ms. Leslie was contacted and offered a position as a checker, a grocery store checker at a separate store, or perhaps the position of a customer service employee. Mr. Weiss clarified that the customer service position was not definitely available, but they definitely had a position for a checker. This event was November 6th of 2000. At this time, both Monty Weiss and Anita Leslie confirmed that the offer was left open as Ms. Leslie had been put on bed rest because of pregnancy complications. Nothing became of the matter for the next couple of months as Ms. Leslie was on maternity leave with her child. She called in January to check on the status of some benefits and was informed that she was terminated. At that point, No further action happens on the case from Hy-Vee's point of view. However, Ms. Leslie did write a letter to the personnel, to the president of Hy-Vee, making assertions that she had been discriminated against and explaining her situation. It wasn't until 3 months after the January termination that she received a phone call from Monty Weiss saying, "Oh, by the way, the position of checker is still available for you if you want it." And I think that's important because and reviewing the court's program on this particular issue, it notes that Ms. Leslie was informed that the option of moving to another store was still open. That was 3 months after her termination. It was not coincident with the termination.
Did she, and it was at the same wage that she received when she left to go on maternity leave, correct?
That is correct.
Doesn't a corporation or a business have a right to move employees around as long as they don't dock their pay or somehow demote them?
I would say that's a couple three-part questions, so I'm going to break it down a little bit. But I think a corporation definitely has the ability to transfer employees around. In fact, a corporation has the ability to fire employees at will in the state of South Dakota. But you cannot fire or demote, as you said, an employee for reasons such as a protected reason under Title VII in response to specific complaints of conduct involving perceived Title VII violations. This was a demotion. This was not a transfer. I know Hy-Vee has tried to characterize this as a transfer. But if you review the body of a Title VII case law, which is cited in the briefs, it says tangible change in employment duties is a adverse employment action. It says demotion is an adverse employment action. There can quite simply be no dispute that there's a tangible change in duties between a personnel manager and a grocery store checker, which is more in the realm of a entry-level position. In fact, Monty Weiss, who is the director of operations for the entire division, testified in his deposition that the position of personnel manager would be a higher position than that of a grocery store checker or a customer service individual. And finally, the Lederberger versus Stanler case, which has been cited by Hy-Vee and by us as well, does note in a footnote that an employer cannot insulate itself from retaliatory discharge or a demotion claim on the basis of moving an employee to a lower position but still giving them the same salary and benefits. The key here is it's different duties, it's different responsibilities, and there's clearly a difference in the prestige of the position of a clerk versus a personnel manager.
Now, you said or implied or whatever that she was basically fired for 3 months and then unfired with this job offer. Well, at any time did your client send any communication to Hy-Vee saying, I'm through with my maternity leave, I'm ready to turn to work?
From my understanding of the record, and admittedly I wasn't the attorney on the case below, she did not do that. The circumstances surrounding the termination were her medical leave and maternity leave were up or were running out, so she called the store to ask about payment of her, or about losing her, about vacation pay and benefits is exactly how the record states it. Brent Heitz, who was the acting store director, was the assistant director, fielded her call because the store manager was ill and out of the store. Brent Heitz called Paul Cole and said, she's calling and asking about these benefits, what do I do? According to Cole's testimony, Cole said, I called Ray Stewart. And Ray Stewart told me exactly what to tell Anita. And I repeated that verbatim to Brent Heinz. In summation, she was told that she would be paid her vacation and sick leave benefits and that she was being terminated.
Was there any reason that they gave on the termination?
There, I believe the specific language that Brent Heinz uses in the record. I do not have the specific language in front of me. Since the time of that phone call, Hy-Vee has basically alleged that this is a personality conflict between these two employees, and because these people couldn't work together, they were terminating her employment. Now, it's interesting, though, if you go back to Paul Cole's testimony when he was deposed, Paul is asked straight out, very beginning of the deposition, why did you terminate Ms. Leslie? She didn't like my style, and I didn't like the way she took things out of context and went behind my back. That's his statement in the record. And I think also important to look at when we're talking about these allegations of personality conflict as a reason for the discharge, you really do need to go back and look at that performance evaluation, because that's very important, especially in the timing of the situation.
Did she bring up any issues prior to October? More specifically in July, did she bring up any issues at all?
I'm going to have to ask you to rephrase the question because I didn't quite catch where you're going.
Regarding the conflict between her and the manager, was there anything that was raised at a time prior to October?
By Ms. Leslie?
Yes.
Between July of 2000 and the time frame of her appraisal rating and October?
Well, any time that after he came as the store manager.
Did she raise any concerns to Hy-Vee or to Mr.?
To anyone.
I believe there is testimony in Ms. Leslie's deposition that she spoke with him in July of 2000. There isn't specific testimony as to what the issues raised at that point were. The first, you know, broken down complaints that we have are October 16th and 17th, which would be the call to personnel and as well, and the call to Monty Weiss.
Okay. Prior to that, during the entire 13 years that she worked there, she worked for the same director, is that correct?
Correct. The same individual was the director up until April of 2000.
I'm trying to focus a little bit more on what is really at stake here. Do you agree that, although you've used the word termination, she's never been fired? There's no question of fact on that. She's taking her job back tomorrow, but it's going to be a checker, right?
Well, I would disagree. She was terminated, and for 3 months, she was under the impression she was terminated, period. That's what Brent Heinz told her in January.
All right.
After that, I will agree with you that 3 months later, after she's again complained, now taken up another step to the president, and basically gotten a rebuff letter, if you read the letter from the president, she was informed that the checker position was open.
Well, I guess I understood from reading your briefs what you were saying there was that she had made this rapid advancement in the Hy-Vee organization, and that looked like the sky was the limit for her based on her abilities and her past record. But now, even though she's making the same money, she's stuck in a dead-end checker job and will probably be always there. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's a fair inference from the record. I mean, and that's where we're at this stage. The court has to remember we're on summary judgment. We have to look at all the facts and the inferences in Ms. Leslie's favor, and I think that's definitely a fair inference from the record. I don't know about that, but I mean, it was over 13 years, and we understand that. But I think that it's borderline undisputed that this woman was subjected to adverse employment action, whether it be a demotion, whether it be a termination. If you read the cases, it's relatively clear that this is a change in duties, and a change in duties and change in prestige is an adverse employment action.
Going back to her first complaint, should it make a difference that in her first complaint, the tenor of it was more about his management style than it was about any of his improper conduct? And then after her termination, then the tenor of her complaint changed to more about his discriminatory conduct?
I don't know that I would agree that the tenor of the first two complaints, and I think we have to look at the two complaints, because the circuit court didn't, and you have to look at those two together. It's undisputed that Hy-Vee has a policy in place, and the policy says if you feel, and that's the language it uses, quote, feel you've been subject to harassment, you should take it to your company vice president. That's the proper procedure for doing it. She took it to Ray Stewart. Ray Stewart referred her over to Monty Weiss. So I do think we need to look at those two together. And there are some complaints that are identical in the two, but reading Mr. Weiss's testimony and Ms. Leslie's testimony and affidavit together as a totality, which the court has to do in this situation, there are management complaints, but there are complaints clearly of improper conduct and conduct that makes her feel uncomfortable in the language she used.
Would you agree, though, that the priority of her complaints changed from the first time to the next time?
2 minutes.
I would say the clarity and maybe the specificity changed after she sought counsel and was, you know, being helped with counsel. But I think it's really important, and getting back to one thing, and that's protected conduct, which I think this case really comes down to. And I think the error in the court's decision, the lower court's decision, is she did not recognize the standard that you have to apply in determining protected conduct. And that's what a reasonable person in Ms. Leslie's position had believed this conduct, or that she was reporting conduct protected by Title VII.
Did Hy-Vee have a policy to protect employees who made these complaints?
It specifically did, and that's attached in our briefs, and I think that's very important, because Hy-Vee even recognizes that it's just as important to protect perceived issues of sexual harassment as founded issues, and that the Eighth Circuit has said it, the Fifth Circuit has said it. It's just as important to protect these perceived issues. It's not mandatory that you win on a hostile work environment claim to win on a retaliatory discharge claim. There's a very good reason for that. It's because if we expect our individuals and our employees to decide ahead of the game whether this is right or not, and know that they're going to be subject to retaliation if I'm wrong, and it's not quite the level of the Eighth Circuit has decided a sexual harassment claim is, I can be fired from making these complaints. We're going to chill employees from making these complaints, and we're going to controvert Title VII's mandate and policy of trying to resolve these at the lowest possible level. Hy-Vee recognizes this by having a policy that says if you feel that you are going to be subject to, or you've been subject to harassment, you should report these without fear of reprisal, and that your confidentiality will be maintained, which circles back exactly to why Monty Weiss's testimony is so important. In that first discussion he had with Mr. Cole, he indicated that he kept her identity a secret. He didn't tell who was making the complaints because he thought he needed to protect her.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Denson, your point, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, counsel, I'm Gary Kempson, and together with Aaron Sabers, we represent Hy-Vee, who is the defendant appellee in this case. I'd like to talk in two phases, one about the sexual harassment claim itself and then about the retaliation issue. And I agree, as Ms. Saber stated, that any issues of fact or all inferences in this case and the court's decision, as was Judge Caldwell's decision in the court below, must be predicated on all inferences being reviewed or deemed in a light most favorable to Anita Leslie, the plaintiff appellant in this case. Now, having said that, we have first the issue of the Title VII sexual harassment case. Is Anita Leslie a member of the protected group? Certainly. Is Hy-Vee an employer within the meaning of that act? Certainly it is. There are other elements, however, that must be met. First and foremost, before I get into the specific allegations, are that the harassment, if harassment it is, must be based on sex. There is absolutely no indication in the record whatsoever that any of the vocabulary claimed to have been used by Mr. Cole, and assumed for this case that it was based in any way on Ms. Leslie's sex. Now, I don't want to be callous here, but I'm often reminded when I see these cases of Claude Rains playing the corrupt police inspector in the movie Casablanca. We live in a society where the F word, the B word, and the T word permeate popular music, virtually all network television. they're heard in about every venue and are clothed in a number of instances with judicial protection. That when somebody utters one in the workplace and a judicial or administrative light is shined on it, everybody pretends to be shocked that that language would be used. Now, I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying that that's the kind of language that we ought to countenance in polite society or in formal or commercial discourse, but nonetheless, it occurs. I would submit.
But isn't that why Title VII was enacted? Wasn't that at least part of the reason why Title VII was enacted?
No, I don't think so, Justice Zinner, with all due respect. Title VII was enacted to eliminate discrimination in the workplace. And in the case of the Mariner Savings Bank, the U.S. Supreme Court said that a hostile environment, i.e. harassment, is in fact a form of discrimination. But the cases are replete from Harris Forklift in the U.S. Supreme Court down to the Scusa, the Stewart, and the Duncan cases, all cited in my brief from the Eighth Circuit, that no, Title VII is not meant to provide a general civility code. It is not meant to remove all sorts of bad conduct or whatever from the workplace, and it's not meant to sterilize the workplace. It is meant only in this hostile environment context to purge the workplace of conduct that is so focused, so permeated, that an ordinary, rational person would find it impossible to continue working there.
Well, why isn't that a jury question in this case?
Because I think as a matter of law, the United States Supreme Court and the Eighth Circuit have spoken repeatedly that isolated, infrequent occurrences...
But isn't that the issue, that it wasn't isolated and infrequent, and therefore the jury should have to decide that?
I don't think that is a genuine issue. She worked for Mr. Cole, I think, for approximately 2 years someplace in that environment. In her own deposition testimony says essentially the incidents were limited to the use of the F word by Mr. Cole, an incident in which he referred to another employee as a bitch. A careful reading of the record will show that that was made over an intercom, and that's not a broadcast or to be confused with a PA system. It's an intra-store telephone system where he said that to another employee. And again, you can like or dislike that word. It was not directed at Ms. Leslie, and there's no showing in the record whatsoever that he wouldn't have said the same thing had there been a male employee there, or on the occasions he used references to female breasts. He was not speaking to her or about any employees. He was speaking on the telephone, and it was a conversation that she overheard. There was an incident where a Hy-Vee, being a family type retail business, you get these posters and you can buy a series of them. They can be rock stars, or they can be cute little kitties in the flower, or in this case, there were celebrities. And one of the celebrity posters, as they come in these frames that you can look at, then you buy them in a tube by the number, happened to be a picture of Madonna, who's a rock star and who was posing topless. The area manager saw that, determined immediately that that was not something that Hy-Vee wanted to offer for sale, and ordered it withdrawn and sent back to the distributor. So it was taken off the rack and was in this general office area when one employee said to another employee, not to Ms. Leslie, the comments that are alleged in the brief about where it is. Again, he said that to another male employee. There's no indication that that was meant to offend or harm Ms. Leslie, or that the conduct occurred because she was a woman in the first instance.
Why is it overly simplistic to suggest that the comments have to be directed at her, or they don't count? Can't you make such a hostile work environment, even if the comments are directed to third parties, that she cannot, even as a reasonable person, tolerate working in that kind of an environment?
I think theoretically you could make that argument. I don't think the record here supports it, factually or otherwise. I think that was Justice Kornkamp's question, and that's exactly right. The issue of sexual harassment or anything gender-based or hostile work environment never ever occurred until after the employment action, and I'll address that in a minute because I agree it was not a termination, was taken. What this lady did was, after a period of time, she called Hy-Vee, and it's, I think it's set forth at page 16 of our brief, and it's a part of the record, the exhibit. She enumerated 10 items of complaint that she had against Mr. Cole. Some people were in a car accident, and he didn't send them a card. He caught some kids smashing pumpkins and made them pay $10 for them. He didn't remember certain employees' birthdays, things of that nature. He bragged about how much vacation time. Nothing. Out of those 10 items, the only item was that the store manager used, quote, bad language, end quote. For purposes of this, let's assume that she was referring to what we would call profanity or vulgar language. She didn't enumerate that, and it was buried as
well. But isn't that an issue? I mean, Ms. Savers indicates that first October call, she actually did complain about the jokes and the F word.
Well, I think that the court is going to have to look at the depositions and refer to the record. That's not my recollection. And unlike Ms. Savers, I did have the benefit of attending all those depositions and being, quote, trial counsel, and that's not my recollection at all.
But assuming, though, that even assuming that her complaints changed their tenor from the first time until after she was, whatever happened, and the manager made a decision that she wasn't going to work in that store anymore, why would that make a difference? I mean, suppose she's afraid to make more complaints. Given what happened to her, would it not be rational for her maybe to bring out all the problems she had after she knew she didn't have a job or thought she didn't have a job?
Well, I think not, and for this reason. Number one, you can't retaliate against somebody if you don't know they've done something. I think that's getting really to the retaliation argument. But at the time the job action was taken, the impression was that her complaints were, you had a guy that said that he had more stock options than his boss, that he took this vacation, that he said he was going over to another store and he didn't, he went someplace else, and he didn't buy ice cream at the employee's birthday party, all these sorts of things. And I think the manager simply said, listen, if she's got all these complaints against me, I don't think I can effectively work with her. I think you have to peruse the record here to understand that the so-called exalted position of personnel manager or personnel supervisor is not a pay grade or a title like a store director or a vice president or whatever else. Some stores have them and some don't. Mr. Cole had chosen never to have one, but when he came into the store and she was there, he said, fine, as long as it's in place, I will keep it.
So a checker and a personnel manager are the same pay grade?
No, well, I'm not sure that they're the same pay grade, and I'm not saying that they are, but I think a customer service clerk, which was another position which she was offered, is on a par. She was told, listen, your complaints about Mr. Cole, which no one at High B perceived to have any kind of a sexual or harassing connotation at the time, is such that we don't think you can effectively work with him. So we'll put you in another store. It's a job you've had before. Your benefits will be the same, and there will be no reduction in pay.
Isn't that a little like saying, Lieutenant, you're going to get the same pay, but from now on you're a corporal? I mean, doesn't everyone in the organization know that she must have done something wrong because one day she's a manager and the next day she comes back into the store and she's a checker?
I don't think so. You can go, there's other positions that she talked about that I guess you and I on the outside might perceive one way or the other, Justice Kornikamp, as being the manager of the cheese island or running customer service, which is important. So I don't think that that's a demotion. Yeah, I think maybe the basic checker is different in perception maybe among co-employees, but as far as any authoritative decision-making or managerial influence, it's not. The personnel manager doesn't hire, fire, interview. They're responsible for monitoring sick days, vacations, and scheduling and the like. But in any event, what I'm saying is this was not a termination. She was offered this other job. She said flat no, and she was called back. Again, I think it's important to peruse the record here. This business about talking to a pregnant female coworker, that was Megan Tischler. Megan Tischler was deposed. This was a conversation between Megan and Mr. Cole. Did not involve Ms. Leslie, and it never came up again until after the termination. Ms. Tischler has continued to work in the 3 or 4 years hence as a Loyal High B employee. She admits that she was distraught, that she handled the situation badly with Mr. Cole, that she did not perceive it to be sexual or threatening or based on her gender or her condition at the time. And so now Ms. Leslie, 3 years later in her deposition, says, well, gee whiz, she claims that he was worried about or upset about paying her benefits, and so that frightened me. But she readily admits, well, as personnel manager, she knew that she had those benefits and they couldn't be taken away, limited, or withdrawn, or otherwise conditioned by her employer or her store director.
What about this 3 month gap cited by Ms. Sabers, where she suggests that her client was without a job and in essence been fired, and all of a sudden Ivy woke up that they may have some exposure here, and then as an afterthought offered her a job 3 months later?
Well, I don't think that's what happened. I think she left and said, no, I will not take this job. But they knew that she was on maternity leave, and then as she herself determined that she was able to return, and I think the FMLA provides for 12 weeks, and that's kind of a benchmark, after 3 months, she called, and they said, yes, we'll make this position available to you. And she said no, and the next thing they heard was a letter from her attorney, and of course, that was the first time that anybody at High V, either in corporate headquarters in West Des Moines, or in Sioux Falls, or any point in between, realized that this was any kind of claim about discrimination, harassment, or otherwise.
Well, however, Ms. Sabers indicated that at some point in time, Stewart recommended that they all sit down and talk, which sounds to me like he at least recognized that there might be some sexual harassment claim.
Well, I disagree, Judge Meyer-Henry, for this reason. I think any sympathetic employer. She pointed out, Ms. Sabers pointed out, and it's true, up until now, this lady had been a good employee. She had gotten good benefits. Mr. Cole was not out to get her.
But this is a summary judgment, and you have to take it in the light most favorable to the party, the opposing party, in this case, Ms. Leslie. And I know those are all arguments that you could definitely argue to the jury, but isn't this getting the cart before the horse, that this should proceed?
I don't think so. I mean, whatever the reason, whether it was pumpkins being smashed or his being insensitive to employee birthdays, Mr. Stewart, in that context, said, let's sit down and talk. She had been a good employee, a 13-year employee. On the other hand, Mr. Cole was a successful store director with a long history with the company, and he wanted to resolve the situation. I don't think he knew that there was a sexual component to the complaint, which never emerged until afterwards, nor do I think, if you have somebody who has a chronic, let's say, lateness problem, and you want to sit down with that employee and his or her supervisor, I don't think it implies that there's any kind of actionable conduct other than simply good management-employee relationship here. She enumerates this list of 10 things. The only one that is the most tendentious relationship at all to any kind of discrimination, well, or harassment would be, he uses, quote, bad language, end quote. She didn't enumerate or say what that language was, and they had these meetings with Mr. Stewart and Mr. Weiss, the employment action was taken, and it was only after that she said, oh yeah, by the way, this was all done because I'm a woman, and it was directed at me, and it was so hostile and pervasive that I couldn't take it. So they can't have retaliated ipso facto if they did not know that there was a Title VII complaint or an actionable complaint even being made.
But isn't that the issue? I mean, isn't there a dispute on the facts on whether or not they knew?
Well, I think we have to talk in the context of summary judgments about material facts. I suppose you could speculate that they should have divined this, and I'm not trying to be facetious here, but much in the nature of Carmack, instead of here's this complaint, and the answer is, she admits that she didn't say that in her deposition. She admits that she didn't make it a sexual thing, that when she called this lady employee who'd been deposed, and whose name I apologize, I can't recall off the top of my head, that she never said that. She never made any sexual complaints about that. She never complained to Mr. Cole or anyone else until she made this phone call and then sent this letter, and then after the employment thing was taken, she met with Mr. Reese and Mr. Cole. She never complained that it was sexual. She continued these complaints about, well, he says he's going over to the other store and he really goes and plays golf. When the managers leave, he tells me that I've got more stock than they do and they can't tell me what to do.
Just so I'm understanding it, the original complaint never talked about his bad language, the jokes, the reference to female anatomy and things like that.
If that's a multiple choice, I'll go with bad language. She did say that he uses, quote, bad language, not that it was female or sexually explicit, or that it was directed toward her in any way. And they were so pervasive. I think again, the fact that Title VII cases are amenable to summary judgment. Look at Scursa versus Nestle in the Eighth Circuit. Look at Stewart versus General Motors and Duncan versus General Motors, where the conduct alleged, and again, presumably for the purposes of those motions, far exceeds the most radical version of the plaintiff's testimony here, was found not to be actionable. You look at here, she's got assuming bad language, meant obscenities, crude and vulgar remarks. That's one of 10 cataloged items that she submits. I think it beggars the imagination as a matter of law to state that somehow that is so pervasive that a normal or rational person objectively couldn't stand it. She never complained to an assistant manager. She never complained to any co-workers about this. She never complained to anyone.
Well, obviously, somebody must have thought she had, there was a concern because they told her that they were going to protect her by not revealing her name. And the store has a policy about protecting employees who make complaints like this?
Well, certainly. I think that's only logical. I think, as a matter of fact, well, there's a body of law that says, well, you don't do that, you violated the employee's privacy. But that's not only in a sexual context.
Obviously, they did eventually reveal her name, because as soon as they revealed her name, she was told she was no longer...
Well, I don't think that's quite the sequence of events. First of all, I think when there's a problem in the store, the first thing the manager who's over the store director does is say, listen, we have an employee who's made these complaints. Are these conditions prevalent? Are you forgetting birthdays? Are you not sending bereaved employees cards? Are you catching little kids and pulling them by the ear when they break pumpkins in the parking lot, particularly seasonable this month? And if he or she can defend him or herself, and if they're unfounded, then you don't have an employee out there who's subject to hard feelings or maybe some exposure. And I don't think that is limited to, pardon me, Your Honor?
You're inside of 2 minutes.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. So what we have here is a matter of law. This one vague item buried in a list of 10 If you look at the summary judgment cases that have been affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, I think as a matter of law, the condition didn't exist. And further, as a matter of law, they could not have retaliated because they didn't know, and no reasonable person could have assumed they knew, prior to the employment action taken, which I contend was not a termination, could not have been a retaliation for a charge that they didn't know was then exit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Sabers, you have 10 minutes.
Initially, I want to clarify something I have in front of me, and it's in the record. It's part of the brief, or part of the depositions, and I believe it's part of the deposition of Ms. Lensley. And it's the memo formed by Mary Bryant after this telephone call. And as I noted in my brief, the memo wasn't contemporaneous. It was made from notes that she took and then added later. Number one, the store director's language is really bad. Number two, the store was going to terminate an unfriendly employee, and the store director said over the intercom, quote, fire the BITCH. Number three, between 6:30 and 8 a.m., the F word was used 25 times. Number four, the store director's on the phone all the time. Number five, tongue jokes. Number six, makes her feel uncomfortable. I don't think I misrepresented as to what that
was. Give us the timing of that, though. She made that complaint now before or after they told her that she wasn't coming back to the store.
That was prior. That was October 16th of 2000. The next thing I want to mention is, again, we get up here today, we have this whole discussion, we hear nothing about the phone call from Monty Weiss. They want to sweep that under the table. They don't want to talk about it, although that is the particular procedure to report a harassment complaint. He doesn't want to talk about that. He doesn't want to talk about the testimony of any of those employees, and there's a reason. He wants you to rely on the testimony of Hy-Vee and what Hy-Vee knew when this happened. But I would urge this court, and Ms. Leslie would urge this court, go back and if nothing else, read the testimony of those three employees. They can't keep their story straight on anything. And if we're looking at the issue of what they knew, what their intent was, the credulity of their statements is an issue of fact in and of itself.
All right, so tell us, what does the record show that they did know before she was told that she wasn't coming back?
They knew she made the complaints I just enumerated on Mary Bryant's letter. They also, Monty Weiss also knew that he had a conversation with her in which he confirms, contrary to what Mr. Simpson just told you, that Ms. Leslie did indicate about an instance when a pregnant employee came in, left, and he said, no little girl is going to come in here and do this. That's in Monty Weiss's testimony. It's also in Anita Leslie's affidavit that she told him that, but that is also confirmed in Monty Weiss's testimony in and of itself. Weiss says, I don't remember if she told me about him talking about breast reductions or tit reductions. I don't remember. But I don't remember doesn't mean there's no dispute, issue of fact, especially when Ms. Leslie says, no, I told him that, and I also told him that Ann Burns came to me and complained to me that he had used that particular phrase. This is one day later than October 17th. This is 2 weeks before she was told that she was no longer going to be in that store, and it was one day, and she was told she was not going to be in that store one day after Ray Stewart and Paul Cole discussed these complaints.
You know, of the complaints that are involved here, I mean, I don't think anyone is going to argue too much about the fact that this individual was engaged in offensive, crude, and poor taste conduct. But of the 10 catalog items, whatever the number might be, which of those shows that this case is one involving gender as opposed to just being crude and offensive to men and women in general? I mean, which pieces of evidence show that this is really discriminating on the basis of gender as opposed to being offensive and crude to men and women alike?
And I think that particularly goes to the hostile work environment claim, somewhat to the retaliation claim. I think particularly in Mary Bryant's memo, the inferences can be drawn that the use of the F word makes her feel uncomfortable and other things make her feel uncomfortable. Also, again, I really can't emphasize enough, I think it's wrong, I think it's improper to rely on this memo in isolation.
Well, can't the use of that word be just as offensive to a male as a female?
It could be, but if you, Mr. Simpson specifically asked Ms. Leslie if she'd seen him use it around anybody else or in anybody else's presence, and she affirmatively said, no, she had not. And in fact, Mr. Cole denies using it altogether. And he doesn't say that, yeah, I did it, and I didn't mean it in a sexual way. He says, I didn't do it. Same with, interestingly, same with the Megan Tischler incident. He completely denies ever seeing that in his deposition, but Monty White says, no, I think it's fair to say he may have admitted saying something like that later on. I think that particular incident does illustrate it's on the basis of sex, because Ms. Leslie was pregnant at the time. He said something which, at least in her mindset, in the situation she was placed in, made her feel that he was angry at giving these women or women pregnancy benefits. And I'll admit that that is her inference. But she should be entitled to explain her reasoning behind her inference to a jury and not be thrown out on a retaliation claim prior to having the jury hit those issues.
We have a reasonable person standard here.
We do.
So I now have in my notes three items of the 10 or so that you're suggesting show gender discrimination. I've more than those three.
I think that as we go through the record in our briefs, we've enumerated that particularly. I think that Justice Kornenkamp had a good point. Obviously, we end up with more, you know, discussion and really thinking about the issues now that she's not there anymore. She's explained in her deposition that previously she had another female employee come to her and complain about conduct of a co-employee. She talked to Mr. Cole about it, and Mr. Cole voiced to her that nothing, or he didn't, her opinion was nothing had been done because Mr. Cole told her that that gal was a nutcase. I mean, he by his conduct, illustrated that a hostile work environment was going to be tolerated. And I don't think we can look at this as a counting game. It's not one item. It's not two items. We have two items. We have to look at her affidavit and how it affected her environment. Justice Marathon hit it exactly on the head. The Eighth Circuit has held, in cases of Title VII sexual harassment, where you have improper conduct and subjective offense, which they've admitted we have subjective offense in this case, is an issue for the jury to decide if it's sufficiently severe and pervasive to constitute a cause of action. There's one or two issues that I really need to go back to on the protected conduct issue to see whether a reasonable person would have believed the student protected conduct, or whether in fact even Hy-Vee perceived it to be protected conduct. Interestingly, in his deposition, Cole was asked, were you ever told not to retaliate against Ms. Leslie for her complaints? Cole said, oh, I think either Monty Weiss or Ray Stewart, or maybe both of them, told me. If this is a personality conflict, Your Honors, and it has nothing to do with Title VII, I don't know why they'd be telling him not to retaliate. I don't know why he retaliated, and my conclusion is that he did. But I think those issues are very important, and I think if you review that testimony of Monty Weiss, again, it's very important. Do you want to address a representation made in their briefs that Ms. and today again that she refused this position, that she refused the demoted positions? That is simply not the case. There is no evidence in the record to say that. At Alita Lenz's deposition at page 112, she says, I wasn't given the opportunity to do it. When I called back, I was terminated. Monty Weiss testifies in his deposition, I do not have the site in front of me, but he testified, we left it open when she left for her maternity leave. He did not speak with her again until March. Paul Cole says, I have no idea what she was going to do with those other positions because I wasn't involved. There is simply no testimony in the record to support the decision or to support the finding in this, or in circuit judge's opinion that she refused these positions. She refused them, but she refused them 3 months after she was told she was terminated.
Your question, 1 minute left.
The only other issue that I'd like to address is this allegation of a personality conflict, and personality conflicts cannot be the basis for a retaliation claim. I think it's important for the court to realize, they've had to do a plethora of cases that say this, personality conflict can't be a retaliation case, but they haven't showed you is a case where the supervisory employee has stated in his deposition, not in so many words, but if you review the deposition, you'll see, as soon as I found out about the complaints, I decided I couldn't work with her anymore. Personality conflict, which arises out of the complaint itself, is nothing more than retaliation. And Ms. Leslie would again ask the court to reverse summary judgment and again review the testimony of those three employees in making its decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.